Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our futures. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm your host. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I invite you to check out at truthout.org. If this program and its contents strike you as interesting and valuable, please make use of the two websites we update continually with new material, interviews I do, articles I write, classes I teach, and all kinds of associated materials that we think you will find interesting. The first website is rdwolf.com, and the other one, democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available to you 24/7 and at no charge. Both of those websites also provide you with two other opportunities. First, to communicate directly with me and my staff to help us design the programs so they serve your needs, provide the information you seek, offer the analyses you find interesting, and the links to other sources of material, and so on. And the second thing we ask you to do is, through either website, click on the icon to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Again, the two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Let me turn, as I always do at the beginning of our programs, to a set of shorter updates. General Motors has been in the news recently, mostly because of a faulty ignition switch that injured many and killed quite a few people, that they clearly knew about years ago, but did not do much about, apparently putting the profitability of producing those cars ahead of the safety of the people using them. And they've gotten themselves into quite a bit of difficulty because of that. But I want to talk about some issues raised by General Motors behavior that's somewhat different. And I think this has to do with the broader lessons of profitability in transportation. You know, transportation is a basic requirement of any and every economic system, indeed of any modern society. And it is a very questionable matter whether we put something as important as transportation into the hands of private profit-making and profit-driven corporations. And the automobile is a case in point. So let me present you with an argument that you might not have heard before, but that I believe is worth thinking about. The automobile and automobile traffic is the largest cause of death and injury in the United States. That's right. People are injured or killed in car accidents every day all over our country. The private automobile is also one of the largest, if not the largest, polluter of the air with the exhausts that come out of the rear ends of our automobiles. Producing automobiles uses up an enormous portion of the resources of our earth, just like disposing of automobiles dumps a lot of garbage into our earth. Putting it all together, the private automobile is injurious to our health multiple ways, threatens our lives. And finally, and perhaps this is what I shouldn't have left for last, moving a person by means of an automobile is more expensive than moving that person by means of a train, a bus, a van, an airplane. Car traffic is an inefficient way of transporting people. Well, then the question you might ask is, why don't we switch to something else? Mass transit, the movement of people or goods in groups rather than individually. A car is a small thing. It moves one or a very small number of people at a time. That's why it's wasteful of scarce fossil fuels, for example. And that's also why it's clogging our roads. And I haven't even discussed that what would it mean to our traffic patterns, to the wear and tear on our road system, and hence the cost of replacing or upgrading our roads, if we had mass transit, buses, vans, trains, and so on, instead of the private automobile. We would injure and kill many fewer people. We would have much less air pollution. We would waste much less in the way of natural resources. We'd be able to move around our cities much more quickly and efficiently. You get the picture? So why do we have private automobiles? Answer, because very big and powerful corporations' profits depend on the private car. A huge amount of plastic is sold to fill up your car. All the oil in the world is gathered to power your private automobile. Rubber is sold to put the tire on your car. All of these corporations, led, of course, by General Motors, Ford, and all the other monster car companies, they want this industry to stay the way it is because it has become very privately profitable for them. They're not worried about the social costs because they don't have to pay them. The rest of us do, in the injuries, in the pollution, in the clutter, and in the lost time on the way to and from jobs or anything else we are driving to. A rational transportation system wouldn't work this way. One driven by what's the safest, most environmentally friendly, best, cheapest way to move people would trump the private profit of corporations. And as I said last week, if what you're concerned about is that doing away with the private automobile industry in favor of mass transit raises the question of jobs, I agree with you. But the best answer to that question is not to shut down the conversation about how much better mass transit would be than the private automobile. It's to answer the question in a creative way. Can we avoid the absurd social costs of the private automobile while still getting the benefits of being moved around in an efficient, speedy, and safe way? And the answer is obvious. Number one, we have already been taught by the likes of Hertz and Avis how to handle the residue need for private cars. At the edge of all cities, there'll be parking lots maintained full-time by teams of mechanics who will keep these cars in good order. And if and when we need a private vehicle to go off in the country or to make a long trip, we will go to pick up those cars and rent them for a short period of time. Number two, a good bit of the people we won't need to produce cars because the number of cars required will be much less, a good number of those people will be put to work producing mass transit vehicles instead, the vans, the buses, the trains, and so on. We can spend time and energy and hire people to make them more beautiful, to make them speedier, to make them more efficient, and to make them more comfortable. We have a lot to learn from our Chinese and European fellow nations who have gone further down that road than we do, than we have. They have faster trains, they have more comfortable trains, and so on. And finally, for those who still don't have work in the mass transit industry, and who still have to find an alternative, let's find them one of the many jobs we need, taking care of kids, rebuilding our cities, doing something for our elderly. Lots of work to do for displaced auto workers who know that we will take care of them and provide them with jobs at the same time that we switch from the private, dangerous, polluting automobile to the mass transit that we will all be grateful we made the transition to. These are powerful arguments. We haven't defeated those arguments. We have silenced them. And we haven't done it out of a rational evaluation. We've done it out of our slavery to the private profitability of those corporations who want to keep us dependent on the private automobile for the most selfish of reasons. My second update has to do with prisoners in Alabama. That's right. Melvin Ray, a courageous inmate at the St. Clair Correctional Facility in Springville, Alabama, is the founder of a prison-based group called the Free Alabama Movement, FAM. He is protesting, together with prisoners across the Alabama system, the way that they pay, or rather don't pay, inmates for work. There are hundreds and hundreds of inmates, perhaps thousands. I don't know the number, and I haven't been able to get a statistic I can reliably report to you. But here's what they are often required to do: work inside the prison. When they work inside the prison that they're incarcerated in, dealing with food preparation, laundry, and maintaining the facility, they are paid exactly nothing for their work. However, the Alabama Department of Corrections also runs a prison industries program which operates 17 different facilities across the state, where inmates do everything from furniture construction to license plate manufacturing. And when they work outside their prisons in these facilities, they receive 35 to 50 cents per hour as compensation. As Ray says, in Alabama, you arrest people not because of any crime they have committed and not because of any rehabilitation you hope and provide for them in jail, but rather as a source of cheap labor. This is, to put a simple point to it, outrageous. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution specifically forbids slavery except as punishment for a crime. We have enslaved the people we put in jail when we force them to work at wages that are way beneath all standards of decency in the world, and they're not even close. 35 to 50 cents an hour. You think you rehabilitate a criminal by forcing him to work or her to work under such conditions? What kind of rage are you building up? What kind of justifiable anger? What kind of lesson are you teaching anybody to exploit them so ruthlessly? And who gets the benefit? And why isn't there protesting outside? The work being done by prisoners for 35 cents an hour is displacing work that might have been done by another person outside the jail who would have gotten paid a proper wage. Who's benefiting by all these profits that are generated by underpaying workers? This is an outrageous abuse. The amendment to the Constitution should have had the courage to ban slavery everywhere. If it is an outrage against human freedom, so is it to do that to a prisoner. Haven't we done enough? Take away his or her freedom? Incarcerated them? Put them subject to the abuses we know afflict all prisoners? We have to enslave them and underpay them as well? That doesn't produce good citizens, folks. It is a self-destructive and vindictive act. Next item. The drought in California is having a number of effects. It is raising the price of water, of all kinds of crops that have to pay outrageous amounts to cope with the drought. It is changing the pattern of farming. It is a disaster to our agricultural industry at a time when our economy is already weak and needs help, not obstacles. Why are we in trouble? Is it because it hasn't rained enough? Not so much. It's because we haven't planned our water usage. Water has been a shrinking and more urgently considered item for a long time. the authorities in California, the West, and across the United States have known about a water problem in various parts of the country. But we don't have the kind of planning apparatus in our society that you need. We don't have the authority in the hands of government to deal with that problem. We leave it to private industry and the market, and they make a mess of it, which is why we have a catastrophe now. If the market were half the efficient institution that its defenders claim, we wouldn't have the GM debacle I just finished analyzing. We wouldn't have the collapsing agriculture structures that are plagued by a drought. We would have found solutions that intelligent people with the resources and the authority could have and would have found. But we are slaves of the market, and we live with its dictates, while the apologists of the market pretend that we can't do better. Shame on them. We can, and we should have. Okay, I want to move now to the first of our larger issues that we're going to be discussing today as we go through some major items that have come to my attention, in some cases because of the communications you have sent to me. The pensions of public employees have become an issue across the United States, particularly in the cities of San Bernardino, Stockton, and San Jose, California, but also in Rhode Island and in countless other states. The one that has gotten the most attention, the one in Detroit, Michigan. What's the issue here? Every city and every state has public employees. You know who they are. They are the school teachers, the police and fire personnel, the clerks that keep the records, the folks that clean the streets. You know, the people who make our cities and states livable, who maintain the public monuments, the public schools, all the public institutions, who look after the public health. These people work all of their adult lives for cities and states, or most of those lives. They are entitled, as are all workers, to a pension. When they've given 40, 50 years of labor, to retire in the final years of their life without care in the sense of being hungry, without a home. They're supposed to get a pension. That's a decent way of treating working people and has been recognized that as that across the world. So what's the problem in these towns? These towns are facing financial difficulties. I'm going to get to those in a minute. So when you are faced with financial difficulties, you try to react. And what these towns have done, aided and abetted by a press that lost its critical faculties, what they have done is fasten on one particular solution to which they are devoting an inordinate proportion of their time and energy. Pensions. They've decided to make pensions the solution to their financial difficulties. Or to say the same thing more sharply, they've decided to cut the pensions, both of the people who are now on the pension, who finished giving their city and state a lifetime of labor, and also to cut the pensions of public employees now and those to be hired in the future to teach the schools, to drive the patrol cars, to put out the fires, to work on the public health, and so on. So let's analyze this. First, pensions neither were nor are the problem. In San Jose, in Stockton, in San Bernardino, in Detroit, in you name it, town or city, the real economic crunch is 5 or 6 years old. It has to do with the economic crisis we're living through. When you unemploy, when you fire millions of American workers, which we've been doing for the last 6 years, when our unemployment rate is today still much higher than it was back in 2007, not as high as it got in 2009, but still not anywhere near back to where it was, when you have unemployment lasting for years at a high level, guess what? Unemployed people don't earn a living, which means they don't pay an income tax. Unemployed people who don't earn much of a living buy fewer things, so they pay less in sales taxes. All of their friends and neighbors and relatives who are worried about their jobs, how secure they are, what benefits they can continue to get, hunker down, spend less money, and therefore pay fewer sales taxes. When you put it together, the cities and states of the United States have been suddenly deluged with a shortfall in the revenue that comes from a depressed economy. That's their problem. Pensioners and public employees didn't cause this crisis. They are not the perpetuators of this crisis. They basically have nothing to do with this crisis. At the same time as unemployment savages the flow of income and sales taxes to cities and states, something else has been going on in the last 25 years, and we've documented that often on this program. Major corporations have found ingenious ways to reduce or avoid altogether the taxes they're supposed to pay. Sales and income taxes to states, property taxes to local communities. They've done it by moving facilities abroad. They've done it by keeping money out of the country and beyond the reach of the tax authorities here. They've done it by manipulating the tax code to give themselves legal exemptions and so on. So you have to add the shortfall in revenue coming to cities and states from the corporations that have evaded and avoided taxation. So you put all this together, and guess what? Cities and states across America are in economic difficulty. No dispute there, that's clear. But it's the crisis and the tax evasion strategies of business that have combined to create that problem. Hence, it is fundamentally unfair to try to solve that problem by taking away the pensions of people who've given years and years of their labor to maintain the cities and states of this country. What are the options facing cities and states in the United States? Are there other ways to deal with the problem? And the answer is, of course. Of course. Here are some of the ways. Tax corporations. They are making more money than they have in decades in this country. They have done better over the last 25 years, including during the crisis, than average people or middle and small businesses. They have more of a capacity to pay now than they ever have, and the rates of tax they are required to pay now are lower than they've been in the last 40 years. You put all that together, and it's an astonishing array of arguments that if you have trouble in America's cities and states, tax those who've gotten away with not paying, who have the lowest rates in decades, and who have the greatest ability to pay. Fairness, decency, elemental logic dictates that's how you solve the problem. You don't savage the pensions of workers. Average pension in San Bernardino, if I remember the numbers correctly, is $19,000 a year. Those are the people you're hurting, and you're letting go those who wouldn't feel the cost of it, who have been doing better than everybody else, who have more than everybody else, and have been paying lower rates than they have in the past. This is a no-brainer, except for the people who have no brains. Number two, here's another solution. Stop paying outrageous fees to banks, stockbrokers and others who give cities little package deals that they claim, to people who don't understand these deals, will be wonderful ways to protect themselves from the economic market swings. Turns out they don't. They've been paying fees to the likes of Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, and others that have cost them a bundle in city after city. Don't do that. Go back to the old ways of being very prudent, and don't give big fees to banks that are hustling you. Learn the lesson of the mistakes you made. Save that money and don't savage workers' pensions. Finally, what about other city services? If you don't have the money and you don't have the political strength or the logic of the mind to go and tax the money from those who could pay, who should pay, and who haven't been paying, if you don't do that, what about the other services the city provides that might be reduced in favor of maintaining the pensions you've promised to the workers who are old? The pensions being accumulated by the workers now and those to be hired. There are, therefore, alternatives. There is no one-to-one matching of the difficulty of a community and the need to cut the pensions. And for those of you that have heard arguments, well, pension costs have been rising. That's true in some cases, but that has nothing to do with greedy workers. That has to do with the fact that our population in the United States is becoming relatively older. We have more older people relative to younger people because of the way people decided to have children over the last 50 years. Yes, more people are getting older, which means more of them are retiring, which means more of them are coming to rely on pensions. But this is not hot news. This is something we knew 5, 10, 20, and 30 years ago. And if the proper planning wasn't done by our political leaders, shame on them. But the solution is not to savage those who were not responsible for this crisis, who were not responsible for what was done in the past by political leaders, etc., etc. One last point. The federal courts are now being asked to overrule state law. In many states, the law says you cannot take money from the pensions of people who paid into them for a lifetime and who now are deserving to get them. You cannot take that away. That's a commitment made, a contract was signed between those workers and their employer. You're breaking the contract. You're basically defrauding those workers from what they contributed to and what they were promised, and in exchange for which they did the work that was asked of them. You can't do it. The federal courts are now being asked to overrule the state courts and to say you can do it. That's what's happening in Detroit. That's what the folks in San Bernardino, Stockton, San Jose, California, and other cities across the country are being confronted with. My response, if the federal law is going to apply, then let the federal government do what's right. If you're going to use federal law and relieve cities and towns from honoring the contracts they signed and on the basis of which they got the work from generations of public employees, then let the government, federal government, come in. Let it use a tax on financial transactions, the Tobin tax, which we've talked about in the past. Let them use a tax on wealthy financiers of the sort many have been calling upon, and so on and so on. Let them raise the money to make good to the working people of this country what's owed them. Then let the federal government come in and supervene state courts and state laws. Otherwise, we're not living in a democratic society. Because if you ever put this to a democratic vote, to the vote of the American people, would you rather see tens of thousands, millions of public employees, after all, your neighbors, your relatives, your friends, have the pensions they contributed to. They were promised, and in exchange for which they were, would you rather see them cut, or would you rather see the 1% richest Americans pay a small percentage of their wealth, something that will not change their lives in one teeny dimension? Which act of solving our nation's financial problems would the majority democratically support? That will not be put to a vote in this country because we all know the answer. Instead, we will have the media and the politicians browbeat everyone into thinking that public employees' pensions are the problem and savaging them is the solution. Shame on a country that does such things. We have come to the midpoint of this program. Please stay with me. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. We'll be back in a very few seconds. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And as usual, I want to remind you of the two websites where you can pursue the topics we discuss here, as well as many other related matters. The first is rdwolff.com. And the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of them are available to you free of charge 24/7. The next larger topic I want to spend a few moments with you discussing today has to do with what is happening to the costs and the finances of higher education in the United States. I need to talk to you about this because it touches our lives in so many ways. As many of you know, we are now experiencing the first generation of college and university students in America racking up enormous debts and carrying them as a burden into the lives they begin upon graduation. It is making them feel that burden on a daily basis. They're filled with anxieties about their capacity to repay, to deal with the interest that is accumulating, to deal with the penalties when they can't pay back on time. It is burdening young people in ways that lead them to make decisions to postpone marriages, to postpone children, to choose careers, not because this is what they love and where they will be most productive, but rather to choose a career where they have the best chance of paying back this enormous burden of loans. It is outrageous what we are doing. It is not happening in anything like this manner in many other countries of the world. So this is not a global trend. It is a disaster. And there are other ways to talk about this that we have done. But today I want to focus specifically on the financing of public higher education. So let's be clear what we're talking about. Public higher education educates more than three quarters of the young people in the United States. That's right. More than three quarters, and by some estimates, as much as 80-85% of American college and university students go to a public school. The private sector of higher education is a small minority sector. You may have heard a lot about private universities, but most of us go to public universities. So that's where we are training and educating the young people who are going to be so crucial to the future of the American economy now that we have to work and live and trade in a global economic system. So what have we been doing in terms of the finances of our public higher schools that train most of our people? Okay, let's give you an example. Up until about two decades ago, 20 years ago, for most middle-class families, financial aid was only marginally necessary. They could afford college educations for their kids. Today, more than 7 out of 10 college seniors borrow to pay for college and graduate with an average debt of $30,000. Okay? Wow. Revenue from tuition, what students are required to pay, accounted for 44% of all operating expenses of public colleges and universities in 2012. That was the highest share ever. 25 years ago, tuition paid for 20%, less than half. In other words, what we have done is required our young people more and more to pay for college educations themselves, because the government isn't going to provide the money to educate our people. We're not going to make public education, the training of our young people, who will therefore be more productive, making our businesses more successful, making our economy more efficient, giving us a secure place in the future. We're not going to do that we all benefit from, as a collective expense. Instead, we're going to heap the burden more and more on the individual family of the students. Here are these statistics, which, by the way, I have gotten from an excellent report put out by the Demos Foundation, D-E-M-O-S, the paper called The Great Cost Shift Continues, State Higher Education Funding After the Recession. Okay, let's see where this goes. 49 states out of 50, the only accepted state is North Dakota, are spending less per student on higher education than they did before the Great Recession, that is, before 2007. 49 out of 50 states are cutting back expenditure. Wow. Between 2001 and 2008, before the recession hit, 33 out of 50 states did that. In many states, the cuts have been especially deep. Since the recession, 28 states have cut per student funding by more than 25%, compared to just one state, Michigan, that did so between 2001 and 2008. Poor Michigan. They did it twice. All right, so now let's take a look at what this means. And here's the most important point of all. We need to understand that we are shooting ourselves in the foot. We are decimating our education system. We are making it harder and harder for young people to go to school, so many of them aren't doing it. We are forcing them to consider training in only those fields that pay, and not in the fields where they will be more excited, more committed, and more interested, and therefore more productive. We are also saying that if you don't have the money to pick up these debts, to pay these bills, you don't qualify. You're not going to be an educated person. We are discriminating and making it possible for higher education only for those who can afford it. That goes against all of the basic ideas of the kind of system we're interested in having. I think this is an extraordinary commentary on what is happening to our society, and I'm very distressed about it, and I hope you are as well. We shouldn't be doing this. We should be collectively funding higher education as most other countries in the world do. We are now saying that we are going to require the individual family to carry the burden. The society as a whole benefits. but the individual is going to have to pay the cost, rather than the society that benefits collectively gathering the cost. Instead of gathering the money from those most able to pay, those who make the most profit off of the productivity of their workers, we're saying, no, 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 the workers themselves have to pay. What a strange notion of what community might mean. The last of the major topics I want to spend a few moments discussing with you have to do with lotteries. I want to talk to you honestly about lotteries. I understand that many of you buy those scratch tickets. I understand that many of you purchase lottery numbers at your local lottery dealer in the states that have them, etc., etc. But I want to be blunt and honest with you about what lotteries were and are and why we have them. Before the 1980s, there were little or no lotteries in the United States, little or no scratch tickets. And the reasons were simple. We had a tax system that worked reasonably well. It raised money in part from poor and middle income people, and it raised money from wealthy people. The top income tax bracket for the richest people in the 1950s and 60s was 91%. Even in the 1970s, it was still 70%. The theory of the progressive income tax was if you have more, the government takes a larger percentage from you because you have the greater capacity to pay. We did pretty well as a nation economically in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We had our problems, but we did pretty well. We have much greater problems now. And the irony is we have lower taxes on corporations and lower taxes on the rich. But of course there was a problem when you cut taxes on rich people and you cut taxes on corporations and you even cut taxes a little bit, not much, on middle and lower income people. It meant the government was bringing less money in. The government, the politicians in our society, are afraid to tax corporations and the rich. That's why the tax on them has come down so far. The rich and the corporations have a simple threat. They hold over politicians. If you don't cut our taxes, we're going to throw our money to your opponent in the next election, and you're going to lose. And they've been pushing the Supreme and other courts to give them greater and greater latitude, to give them greater and greater latitude to give money. And as you know, in recent decisions, there are literally no limits on how much money corporations and rich people can give to get the politician of their choice. And who's that? The politician that cuts their taxes the most. And that's what they've gotten. But that has pinched what governments can do. For a while, they jacked up the taxes of the mass of people. Even to this year and last year, we pay back a high payroll tax that had been reduced during the Great Recession, 2009, 10, and 11, because we were having such difficulty. But they raised it again. Can you imagine? Amazing. But then the people revolted. That's why so many Americans are just dead set against tax increases, are willing to support extremely conservative politicians with whom they disagree on a whole range of issues, but they are desperate not to have their taxes raised because they can't pay it anymore and they can't control what they have to pay in prices for the goods they buy, the services they buy, so they want to control the politician so at least their taxes don't go up. The politicians then, however, don't have the money to do what the big corporations and the rich and the mass of people want them to do in the way of providing services. How could they solve this problem? Well, the big solution of the governments has been to borrow money, which is why they all go into terrible debt. Because that's not a mistake they're making. That's the only way to resolve a situation in which you fear to tax the rich because they won't give you the money. And you fear to tax the mass of people because they won't give you their votes. And yet the mass and the rich want you to provide services. So you borrow instead. We've been through that. But there's another, it's much smaller, but another way of solving the problem. And that's called gambling, lotteries, scratch tickets. These are simply a tax called something else. How do I know that? Let's see. First, if you see who buys the bulk of the scratch tickets and the lottery. You guess what? It's the middle and the lower incomes. It's the people who they are afraid to tax, but now they found a way to tax them, a way to get money out of their pocket to run the government. Here's how it's done. By telling them you have a 1 in 1,000,000 chance to win the lottery. You have 1 in 1,000 chance to win a buck by scratching a ticket. It's just a tax in another name. But you know, it's not even as good as a tax. If you pay a tax, at least then the money goes to the government, which is supposed to use it to provide services. When you buy a lottery ticket first, a portion of that money goes to the store owner who runs the lottery machine where you bought your ticket. Another part of that money goes to the bureaucracy that puts out advertisements about the lottery, that runs the lottery, that keeps the records of the lottery. And finally, a part of what you pay as a ticket is the money used to give to the few individuals who win the lottery. So what's actually left for the government to use to provide services is much less than if you had called a tax and had it paid as such. But you know, it's worse even. When you sell lottery tickets, here's what you do. You take a little bit of money from lots of medium and low income people. They're the ones who buy most of the tickets. That dollar that Mrs. Smith uses to buy a lottery ticket, she might have used to buy a piece of food, a piece of clothing. That would have created demand for goods and services. That might have created jobs producing goods and services. That might have created income for the people she spent that money on. That in turn would have been turned around by those people. It would have been an economic stimulus. Instead, that money is withdrawn from the economy and given to whom? To a few people who become rich. And here's what we know about rich people. When you have a lot of money, you save a good portion of it. You don't spend it. You keep it back. You're rich enough to be able to enjoy life and still have savings for the future, and you indulge that desire. And so the result is less of the money is spent on goods and services. You know what we need in the United States today? More money spent on goods and services to create demand, to create that money to turn over, to build the economy. A lottery takes a little bit from everybody and concentrates it in the hand of a few who will not spend it. It actually makes our economic crisis worse. Not good for government expenditure because so much of the money can't be used to provide services. So it's a substitute tax that doesn't work as well as a tax. And what's the basis? Mirage. Giving middle and low income people facing a disastrous future in a declining economy the fantasy for a few hours of imagining what I would do if I had 1,000,000, what I would do if I had 10,000. And for those few hours of a cruelly unsatisfied fantasy, we have an inefficient tax substitute. That's what lotteries are. And they are typically used by a society that does not know how to solve its problems better than that. Okay, we've come to that part of the program where I respond to questions that you have sent in. And today I want to respond to several. First, a technical question, easy to answer. Does the Federal Reserve create money? The answer is yes. That's one of its central functions. The Federal Reserve, which is what the central bank in this country is, every country has a central bank. In most countries, it's called the Bank of Japan or the Bank of England or the Bank of France. We can't call it the Bank of the United States because of our history when we once had such a bank and it got itself into all kinds of political disputes. So we rechristened it the Federal Reserve System. It's just our bank. And one of the tasks of the banking system, of the governmental banking system, and the Federal Reserve is a kind of a composite. It is partly the government and partly the creature of private banks who have a very powerful influence in what happens there. But one of the jobs of the central bank is to control the money supply. I like to explain this to people because I want everyone to understand that when you hear people say, gee, we want to get the government out of the economy, Mostly these people are talking through the top of their head and not this part, not the mouth, some other part. Anyway, what they're not understanding is that all modern societies give to their governments the control over the money supply, over a large part of the money supply, if not all of it, because they're not going to rely on private enterprises to control the money supply completely, because then what we have as the way of money, which we all depend on in a modern economy, would be controlled by people whose motivations are their private profit, and that's too dangerous. Let me say that again. Relying on the private profit motive is too dangerous for something that is so important for us as a community, as a collectivity, as a society. So we give the government the job of deciding how much money there is, how many dollar bills and $10 bills and $20 bills and all the rest. And the Federal Reserve creates the money. It orders the printed money to be printed. It orders the coins to be made. It orders and controls the size of private banks' accounts at the Federal Reserve, accounts they can draw on, and that the Federal Reserve can simply say tomorrow is larger by X billion dollars than it was last year. Now this bank has X billion more to draw on. So it creates electronic money, paper money, and coins. And it is supposed to do that in a way that maintains a reasonable condition for our economics, that we don't have too much unemployment, that we don't have too much inflation, and so on. It's a judgment call, and we give them that power. But that's where the quantity of money is most clearly controlled, by that governmental, quasi-private, quasi-governmental arrangement of an agency in which banks and politicians share a lot of authority. And that we do like other societies. But the notion that we don't have the government involved in our economy is obviously rendered ridiculous once you understand the role of the Federal Reserve. Something as fundamentally as important as the quantity of money we have is shaped by our government. And if you literally meant to get the government out of the economy and it wasn't going to control the money supply, Lord help us as to what would happen. Most societies have a central bank precisely because they had the experience of the economic and political chaos produced if you let the money supply be managed by private profit-driven enterprises. Okay, another question. What are the reasons that an advanced industrial economy like those Japan, North America, Western Europe, what does it mean to say, and what are the reasons why they go to other countries? The reasons are always multiple. One company goes for one reason, another for another. But here's a list to keep in mind when you're thinking about this. Companies go abroad when they need to get reliable sources of raw material. They buy them there and ship them home, or they establish enterprises out there in the other country to be able to buy them, to process them, and to ship them back. The second reason corporations go abroad is for food, to provide for food, either because they manufacture food. For example, coffee companies go to other countries for the simple reason that in most of the United States you can't grow coffee. In fact, in very few parts of the United States, Louisiana, Hawaii, and so on, we can produce coffee, but nowhere near enough. So if we're going to be a country that drinks coffee, which we surely are, we're going to have companies that either buy the coffee abroad or take ownership of coffee producing farms abroad and so on. So raw materials, food, markets. Corporations need people to buy what they produce. Some of those buyers are abroad. They need to establish themselves in places where they can find and sustain buyers. So you go abroad to find a market. Finally, you may also go abroad to get cheap labor, because it's cheaper than hiring workers in the United States. That's been particularly important in recent years. And still more, you can go abroad because their taxes are lower and you prefer to produce there, or they don't have environmental protection rules the way we do here. All of these reasons can motivate a company. Usually combination of these reasons are motivate a company to act abroad, to buy and sell abroad, to establish facilities abroad, to move production abroad. And here, notice this. Companies do that because it's privately profitable for them to do that. And you know what often happens? They get into difficulty. They have conflicts abroad. And when they have conflicts and they don't know how to solve them themselves, guess what? They call upon the American government to help them, to protect them, to intervene, even with soldiers sometimes, to make sure they're treated properly, that they can continue to earn profits. And who pays for the soldiers and the cost of helping them? You and I do. The government uses tax money to get the military apparatus together to protect what? The private interests of private corporations who made a private decision to maximize their private profit by going abroad. Colonialism, imperialism, and foreign adventures usually are about the pressure exerted by American businesses dependent on profits abroad who want the government, at the cost to the taxpayer, to protect, to advance, and to secure their foreign-based interests. That's where the politics of a foreign entanglement become everybody's business. And one of the solutions to conditions that end up being wars like in Vietnam or Korea or Afghanistan or Iraq is to raise the question, rather than the government and the public being brought in at the end to save what these enterprises did, why aren't we in there at the beginning being part of a decision and making sure we decide whether we want the gains of a foreign entanglement economically if it's going to risk causing us politically and militarily? Thank you so much for being with me today. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update, and I hope you will join me again next week.
Change.